Emil Guillermo is back. He's the host of the PETA podcast, which you can download on iTunes. Go to PETA.org. Hello, Mr. Guillermo.
Hello, Mr. Feldman. So good to be on your podcast.
Thank you. Today we're going to talk about Mohair, Down, Forever 21, the Preakness and the Kentucky Derby, SeaWorld. And then if we have time and I behave and I don't take you on a detour, we'll talk about your performance at the Orlando Fringe this Wednesday at the Blue Venue. Emil Guillermo, I should mention, is an American print and broadcast journalist. His column, Emil Amok, appeared for more than 14 years in Asian Week, and you can now read it over at the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund site blog. He's also won an American Book Award. He's been on all the networks, as well as NPR, and most importantly to me, he's the host of the PETA podcast. Welcome back, sir.
David, thank you for that introduction. I like myself now more after hearing that.
Well, who is Tracy Ryman? I understand you interviewed her on the PETA podcast, which I didn't hear this week's PETA podcast.
Well, she's on the one that drops on Wednesday. She is she's the executive vice president of PETA. I've known her when she first got to PETA, when it was in Rockville, Maryland, 26 years ago. And back in those days, people had picket signs and they went out there. She was a bold and idealistic activist. Now she's the executive vice president. And it really is amazing how we talk about how the evolution of protests has occurred, where now companies come to PETA and say, please call off your protesters. We want to work with you, but we don't want to be public about it. And so we
is
talked
PETA
about that.
Is PETA a shakedown operation?
No. PETA is not a shakedown. Well, shakedown operation in terms of what? Like the old mafia protection type of thing?
Yeah, nice corporation you got here. It would be a shame if that you're using mohair.
No, the thing is, PETA is for the ethical treatment of animals. And what's happened is when you have a corporation and you don't believe in that, well, you're going to hear from PETA. And you're not just going to hear from the company. You're going to hear from the PETA members, the activists. And corporations are now saying, hey, look, we don't want that. We want to work with you. But they don't know how. And so they become a resource. And PETA is willing to do it. It's not really a shakedown operation. Although I do ask her. You have to see what she says. And I said, is PETA sort of being used here by these corporations? But, you know, if there's any, if they flail about, if the corporations renege on anything, well, you know, certainly they will hear, not just from PETA, but from all the PETA supporters. So I think it's a funny kind of mutual way that advocacy and activism and corporate ethics have kind of come together to make it better, to make the world cruelty-free.
Yeah, I don't believe in corporate responsibility. I believe in corporate fear. You have to terrify these corporations because they do listen. You're more likely to get Delta Airlines to sever its ties with the NRA than the Republican Party. So it's very effective going after corporations. You really do vote with your dollar. So tell me about mohair. What is mohair?
Mohair is
I keep saying to my dermatologist, I need mohair. These hair plugs are fine and dandy, but I need mohair.
Mohair. Look, when I was a kid, I'm talking about junior high, and, you know, I was into soul music because I went to what they call an urban inner city core junior high. I would admire people who wore mohair slacks, and not just regular mohair slacks. I mean, the orange mohair slacks.
These are just women who didn't shave their legs, my friend. What is mohair? Answer the committee, Emil Guillermo, host of the PETA podcast. What is mohair?
Well, mohair is a kind of wool. Wool comes from sheep, but mohair is a kind of wool, but it in this case, it comes from goats. It's cheaper than regular wool. And since the wool
I would assume it's not comfortable.
Well, it's the
goats are not comfortable.
Well, this is the thing. The goat mohair industry is based in South Africa, and no one has ever done an undercover investigation of the farms, the goat farms. And
answer my question, sir. I'm going to grill you. I'm the Grand Inquisitor.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
The problem here is you and I go back before each other were born.
That's true.
So
we were zygotic.
What does that mean?
Well, you know, before you get to a sperm and egg, you know, you get the zygotes form.
Oh, okay. All right. So, and the danger we run into is our familiarity, because the audience doesn't care. So answer my questions.
Yes.
What is mohair?
Mohair, it's the hair from, in this case, it's a hair from a goat. And it's cheaper than wool, like I said. So people have turned away from wool in the United States and other companies, and they're starting to source these shearings from
okay,
goats.
Okay, so let me stop you for one quick second there, sir, because you know I believe in PETA. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Yes.
You mm-hmm. know that I think how we treat animals.
Come after me, baby. Come on.
Okay. No, I'm not coming after you.
Yeah.
I just need to get... When you shear a goat, mm-hmm. you're not killing a goat.
No, but you're not doing him any favors either. I mean, and some of the...
Is it okay to wear wool?
No, it's not okay to wear wool. I mean, you know, there are so many other synthetics available now that there are cruelty-free alternatives.
Hang on. I'm going to grill you because...
Yeah.
It is, according to PETA, immoral to wear a wool sweater because there are... sheep walking around with comb overs? I mean, what happens when you shear a sheep?
Well, it's funny. And I think what if you see the mohair investigation on PETA.org, there are really some, you're going to need some synonyms for horrific, because you can't say horrific enough. I mean, you'll see abhorrent, horrid, you'll see these
what happens hideous. What happens to a goat after it's been sheared?
Well, they first of all, how they shear them, right, is no party. You can see these videos where you can hear the baby goats, right, kids, right, crying, and they sound like children, and so you know that this is not a cruelty free operation.
When I get my hair cut, mm-hmm. I don't cry.
Well, they don't beat you over the head either, and they. They don't.
So, in other words, in order to get the goat to stand still, they're doing something that's cruel.
Oh yeah, they're manhandling these goats. They're dragging them around. Like I said, it's Tracy described it as a horror show, and people can see the video for themselves at PETA.org. It's not fun and games there. And
is there a way to shear a goat or a sheep ethically, or it's just...
No. I asked that question. There is no way to shear these goats and then say, okay, now go free. No, you're going to recycle this. And in the process, they ultimately end up dying.
Why?
Well, either from the beating or how they're treated or, you know, it's just, you know, my point is that I asked Tracy if they could do it more humanely. And it was an unequivocal no. And so I think, like you said, if people see this investigation and for a long time, the mohair industry has avoided, you know, any kind of scrutiny, and PETA was able to get undercover investigators with video, 12 goat farms. And before they went public with the protest and the investigation, they actually went to the companies who outsourced from these farms, and they began to change their habits and stop making mohair. And now the biggest company that is, you know, on the fence and needs to be convinced is Forever 21. So once again, this is part of PETA's practice. I mean, they find out the information, they go with the information to companies. Companies willingly change and become more ethical.
All right, now I go to Forever 21.
Yeah, even though you're what? How old?
210.
Yeah, okay, that's good.
All right, I see Forever 21 in the malls when I'm with Judge Roy Moore, when we're walking around the malls together. And why is Forever 21 being blamed for mohair? Why specifically?
Well, they're just one in the latest list of companies that have mohair products, and they have not yet signed on to this master list of companies that have decided to not use mohair, to not use or not source through these South Africa farms. And like I said, I suggest that people go to see the list at PETA.org. Okay. And you know, it doesn't take much.
What's worse, according to PETA, a mohair sweater or a wool sweater, sheep wool?
Sheep wool is bad. That's why people went to mohair. Mohair was the alternative, according to Tracy. And now people are discovering, because no one has really looked at the mohair industry, now people are discovering that mohair is just as bad. You can't go to a goat and say that the wool of the goat is better than the wool from a sheep. And all down the line, they did a big, massive investigation over Angora rabbits in China.
What is Angora? Angora sweaters, what?
Angora is another animal fur, in this case, rabbits. They were farmed in China and outsourced from there. And it was discovered, once again, through investigations, that it was not humane. There was no humane way to do it. And so, like I said, in my interview with Tracy, she talks about how, because I asked her, I even asked her about down. We've talked about down. You mentioned down pillows in a previous segment. And it's not like they're plucking the ducks are plucking their feathers and handing them to, the people saying, here, come take my feathers, please. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't, and when you get to the issue of, well, isn't live plucked, is that better? Sort of like free range chicken? Well, no, because like I said, they're fully conscious when they're being plucked, and then they're often killed fully conscious. There's just no humane way.
Right. And it presupposes, when it comes to down, that killing and then eating goose and duck is wrong, which it is.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't know what happens to the end product, in terms of after they're plucked and then they die, and then I guess I don't know if they eat them or if they're sold to the into the meat industry, but it's just from beginning to end, it's just, if it's not humane, if it's cruel, then PETA gets involved.
Right. Okay. SeaWorld.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, I just talked to Tracy about corporate activism and how it's changed. And she mentioned how SeaWorld is slowly changing. They just released some financials that showed that they actually have an uptick in their business after, months and months of no growth and losses because of their use of orcas. But Tracy suggests that it's linked to the animal-free type of SeaWorld that we're seeing now. And maybe we will start to see a change in with no animals at all. I mean, Tracy talks about maybe SeaWorld going to more education, a SeaWorld without animals kind of thing. But it's just another example. They're a little more. SeaWorld is an example of a corporation that is more reluctant than others. Some are openly embrace PETA, some quietly embrace PETA, and some are just downright reluctant, like SeaWorld. But ultimately, they see that the practice of now in all the billboards in LA, SeaWorld is pushing its rides, it's pushing its roller coasters. It's not pushing orcas. There's no mention of animals, and that has to be because of the public pressure brought to bear by protests that emanated from PETA.
Yeah, because of the movie Blackfish.
Yeah,
which
Blackfish.
I've talked about a captive orca named Tilikum. Are orcas dolphins or whales?
You know, God, Dave, you asked it.
It's like a trick question. They look like whales, but they're part of the dolphin family, I think.
Well, yeah, I think I'm the wrong person to ask about that. I just ask the questions on my podcast too.
Yeah. So when my kids were young, I used to take them to SeaWorld. I hate to admit it. I didn't know.
And did they like it, or did they get
turned
off?
They loved it, and they gained an appreciation of hurting sentient beings. No, they gained an appreciation. I mean, there was some. I mean, both my kids are vegan.
Yeah.
They one of them occasionally eats fish. But is there no value to zoos and SeaWorld to see animals in captivity?
I don't think.
I kind of mean this in a way. That,
yeah, I think you gain an appreciation from seeing a photograph or a picture, but to see a live zoo, I haven't been to a live zoo in decades. Maybe when I went to do a panda story was the last time, and when I did a panda story might have been in the 80s.
If I met Ingrid Newkirk, and I'm being absolutely serious here.
Yes.
And I said, and I know this sounds glib and I'm trying to be cute, but I'm not.
Okay.
I live in Manhattan in a box. Mm-hmm. I'm in captivity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trapped on the island of Manhattan and I can't get out. I have no privacy. But, you know, I'm in show business. I'm making the world better.
That's what you call it, show business, right?
Yeah. You know, people pay to see me hurl feces and eat a banana and hump another comic and swing on a tire. It's show business.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's a form of captivity.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking of something bigger than myself. I'm sacrificing my self-esteem so people could learn about the human condition.
Yeah.
So the orangutan in the zoo.
Uh-huh.
You're Ingrid Newkirk. I know you think I'm trying to be funny, and I'm not.
Mm-hmm. I know. You think that because you're serving some higher purpose. I don't think the orangutan was given a choice about higher purpose.
I wasn't given a choice to be a comedian.
You aren't? Oh, it's in your blood.
Yeah. And so I'm in captivity in Manhattan in a box. People look at me. They mock me. I'm pathetic, but I bring a little joy and insight, and maybe the next generation of humans will be treated better. There's no value to a zoo to put animals on display so people can appreciate us.
There are other ways to appreciate you. I'm sure, David, you could take your animal friends and maybe take photographs and say people can look at them. There are alternatives to a zoo. You don't have to keep these animals in captivity. In fact, in Manhattan, you are able to walk out your door. But many animals in zoos, they are not able to walk out their doors. So
I'm my own gatekeeper. There's a level of depression.
That's true.
There's a level of agoraphobia and xenophobia. There's a level of agoraphobia that comes with show business where you become your own captor.
Yeah. You know, I get that. And now since I've been doing my one man show, I kind of get that. I know where you're coming from.
Okay.
But to get back to you, because, you know, I put myself out there as the fool, right? So that people can learn about my story about being Filipino.
We'll talk about that in a second. Let's get
But back to this thing. But it's no different from, I can see where animals, for a lot of people, that's the first, their first connection to the animals, right? But we don't have to do it that way. There are better ways to do it. And we don't have to, the animals aren't given that choice. When they make the choice, I think then maybe you have more of a point.
Okay.
But I think if they don't, if they're just captured in the wild, put in cages, brought in, and then showcased, I don't think there's any usefulness in that.
All right, now I'm being funny. Now I'm gonna try to be funny.
Okay.
What would Ingrid Newkirk or Miss Ryman, Tracy Ryman, say about cats? Cats in an apartment, they're captive.
Well, I think what they would say about cats and dogs, they're our companions. They are not pets. They are animal companions. And as animal companions, they have a special part and a special role in our lives. And I think all you have to do is just have, I mean, we've rescued so many dogs, my wife and I, over the years. And most of them are older dogs. And when they die, also older cats. When people have cats.
So PETA breaks animals into two groups, companions and then just animals.
Well, there are animals. The mountain lion up in the hills is welcome to be my companion, but I think he or she would rather be out there in the wild fighting developers, real estate developers. Right. Right. But I think that the difference is when you have your cat, it's a part of your family. And that's a difference. I can't tell you the amount of tears I have spilled, over these animals that were not part of my family, but became, members of my family. Mm-hmm. And I still think about them. It doesn't go away, right?
All right. You know, I love the ponies.
Yes.
Nothing calms me down more than heading out to the track, smoking a cigar, and watching the ponies.
Yeah.
No, best use of my time is to go to the track. Love to watch horse racing. Love it.
Really? No, you're kidding. Me,
Queen Elizabeth and I are constantly talking about rutting season.
You know, I've been to the QE too. Across the pond and the Kentucky Derby, and I am a reformed horse racing fan, but since my PETA days, no more.
Okay, so who is the winner of the Kentucky Derby?
Well, the winner of the Kentucky Derby was a horse named Justify.
Justify
looked like, as they say in the horse racing biz, could be any kind, meaning a real champion, maybe the type of a secretariat, because he won handily in the mud when they raced in Churchill Downs on the first Saturday of May. And then after the race, they took him to a news conference and they walked him around, and someone noticed his left hind leg was sort of hurting him, that he was kind of lame or limp. And so PETA issued a statement saying a veterinarian should look and re-examine Justify to see if he was hurt coming out of that race. And the trainer, Bob Baffert, said at first, it's just what a condition called scratches, meaning that's a term referring to a kind of a baby rash type of thing on the skin. It turns out the Kentucky Horse Racing Board did examine the horse afterwards, took PETA's suggestion, found out that it wasn't scratches, it was a bruised heel. And now the question is, can Justify recover enough from the bruised heel to run in the next leg of the Triple Crown, which is the Preakness, which is coming up later this month? And that's the buzz in the horse racing world, because, of course, they want to see a Triple Crown victor, wins the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness, and the Belmont. But if Justify isn't able to run, would Bob Baffert, the trainer, do something to make him run? And that means maybe doing something that might not be on the up and up, That's the open question. Baffert has a history of using drug uses on horses to get them to run, and it shouldn't be, especially in the biggest races, it shouldn't be that unfit horses run because of the use of drugs. Because if they're unfit, they should rest. They should get better. It's abusive. And this is one of the things about the racing industry that Pete has tried to shine a light on, that the amount of drug use in racing has just gotten out of control. And they're not telling people who are bettors about this. And if you're a bettor, you know, whether it's $2, 50 cents, or $100, or $2,000, and if you're not given information that a horse is sick or a horse is injured, but they're applying or giving drugs to that horse, you know, that's information that should be made public, should be transparent, or should the use of drugs should be illegal to stop that kind of thing from happening. And so that's what people are waiting to see what happens before the Preakness. If Justify will run, if he's well. And this really goes to the heart of all that's wrong with racing.
I would assume that PETA doesn't endorse racing at all.
It doesn't endorse racing. In fact, PETA would like, would like nothing more for the industry to go away. But the industry keeps hanging on. It's gambling. Tracks are sort of falling apart on their own. But they still linger. And while they're lingering, PETA is shining a light on things that could be better. I mean, if it's going to exist, even in its in its state that it's in, just barely hanging on with not really enticing new fans, just dealing with, old fans like you with your cigar in the daily racing form.
Yeah.
The idea is what can be done to improve while we still have this thing called horse racing? And that would be to curtail the use of drugs.
Is there, and I guess you need to do a show on this for the PETA podcast, is there any justification for hunting?
I would say P would say unequivocally no.
What if coyotes are I just had this conversation with a hunter.
Yeah.
Who says that there's an epidemic of coyotes in New York State that have to be hunted.
Well, they say this about other things, about an epidemic, or you mean like a surplus? Like
a surplus. They need to.
Yeah, yeah. It's the same kind of argument they use with deers in the past. And in the past, look, there are other ways to get rid of coyotes if you want to get rid of coyotes. And it's not a joke, but have you considered birth control?
Right. That's what they're doing in Staten Island with deer.
Yeah. The thing is that whenever there's a cruel answer to a problem, there's also an alternative. There's a cruelty-free answer to a problem. And I think if you were to stop Ingrid or Tracy or any PETA person, they would say the same thing. Is hunting ever justifiable? I don't think it is.
Yeah. I'm thinking of a bit on the Hulu series that Triumph the Insult Comic Dog did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We had a pamphlet. We had a mock pamphlet from Planned Parenthood encouraging fisting as a way to cut down on pregnancies. And people actually believed. We went to Iowa and spoke to Trump supporters and asked them, what do you think of Planned Parenthood's teaching of fisting to young couples as a form of birth control? It's on Hulu. It's pretty amazing.
Hey, look, I've liked that series, by the way, and I watched it during the campaign. But
it's the best.
PETA has done in these investigations, and they have uncovered in like factory farms the amount of sexual abuse that goes on. between human and animal will astound you.
All right, that's from that's for another show.
A future show.
Future show. I would like in the future to discuss with you bestiality.
Okay. But man's best friend.
But not as the voice of PETA, because I have a feeling if Ingrid Newkirk heard that, she would sever ties with you.
I'm not the voice of PETA. I happen to be a podcaster with I have a deep affection for PETA, but I try to be objective, and also I try to ask the hard questions of them. Yeah. I mean,
curious about hunting, because what does hunting do to hunters? I had a conversation last night with a hunter. Mm-hmm. Very scary. Yeah. Very scary. Very quickly, you're in Orlando performing at the Orlando Fringe. What I should mention is that besides being an award-winning broadcast journalist, Emil Guillermo also does a one-man show around the country, and his current one-man show is Amok Monologues, All Pucked Up, and this is about Harvard, NPR, and more.
That's right. That's right. I mean, and there are funny parts, but, you know, because I am a solo performer, I am not afraid of the silences.
Yeah. Well, the Buddha says silence is where the comedy is, especially when David Feldman is performing. So can't shake. You were Harvard Lampoon. You still can't shake the comedy.
I can't. I tried. Well, you know, at Harvard, when I got there, I thought I was a funny guy, but I would not expose myself. And instead I did funny things for the business board, and I actually sold the first condom ads in the Lampoon just to spice up the magazine. And, you know, I was charming at the cocktail parties. And so I was in the club. I was in the special fraternity that I always.
You were Harvard Lampoon. You were in the castle.
I was in the castle. I was in I was in the inner sanctum. It really was the high point of my life, I thought, at the time as an 18-year-old boy. I elected in freshman year and then somewhat turned off by it ultimately because my overall Harvard experience. And that's part of the show.
Yeah.
Okay. But I've gotten together with some of my Harvard Lampoon buddies every now and then, and we share stories about the castle and about what it was like. But, you know, they moved on into professional comedy, and I went into this news thing. And this is a way, the show is just a way to put some things in perspective about my life. You know, my father, believe it or not, came to America in 1928, which is like 90 years ago. This summer. And, you know, and I, 90 years ago, and I'm so young and vibrant, and what happened? You know, it's like, I'm trying to make sense out of my life when there's this missing generation that comes in. And then as I dug in and found out about how Filipinos were treated in the 1930s, did you know that there was rampant, full-blown Filipino phobia in the 1930s? I mean, they were saying, the Filipinos are coming, the Filipinos are coming. I mean, literally and figuratively, that we were stealing jobs, like most immigrants do, because immigrants like to steal jobs from white people. But we were stealing white women. And it was really a sexual thing that went on between, you know, white men and Filipinos that caused this Filipino phobia, which makes it even more virulent than the kind of Islamophobia that we see now, because that's just, what's that? That's just religion. But this was
sexual, yeah.
It's like Emmett Till times, well, there are 30,000 Filipino males, and when they pass those anti-miscegenation bills or laws, especially in California, well, and then they didn't bring.
So in California, it was against the law for a Filipino to mate with a white woman.
it was against law. That's why every time I see a white woman, it's like the call to for justice.
You're turned on by them.
Yeah. That's why I married a couple of them. That's how I've been married to one.
It's the forbidden.
I guess I never really thought about it that way, but you know, I was dating my wife, you know, back in the 80s, and I remember an old Filipino guy would come up to me and said, "Oh, we used to be killed if we were seen with that kind of girl," and he was serious. You know, mm-hmm. there were lynchings. People don't know about this history, the Filipino American history, but they were the first colonized. You know, when the U.S. had its empire.
Sure.
And they brought over. Now, this is kind of interesting for your New York crowd. They brought Filipinos over in 1904 to the World's Fair in human zoos. They brought over 1,400 Filipinos. They were called Igorots. And actually, the Igorots were one tribe, and then there was others from the south, from Mindanao. They brought them over to eat dog, and they said, "You will eat dog on cue."
That's fascinating.
Imagine the indignity of having to eat dog on cue. And the Filipinos would say, "We don't eat dog all the time, just on special occasions." And so there was they were at the World's Fair in 1904, but then they migrated eastward because they saw they were such a big hit at the World's Fair. They were an even bigger hit on Coney Island. And on Coney Island in 1905 to about 1914, 15, they had these shows in Coney Island, "See the Filipinos." And they'd bang gongs. It's like a peep show, the Filipino peep show. And so I talk about that on my show, that this was sort of like a thing back then that kind of framed from the first footsteps on American soil, the Filipino experience or the Filipino idea, you know, to America. And of course, they were brought over because they were trying to show Americans that, look at these savages. We need to colonize these savages. We need to do something about these people. We need to save them. And then ultimately, when I was born, finally, they gave me a full ride to Harvard.
The Filipinos who were treated like zoo animals, mm-hmm. Do we know what happened to them?
Yeah. They were treated like zoo animals, but then they became celebrities. When people started to flock to these shows. I mean, they were like off Broadway on Coney Island, making thousands of dollars, as much as some Broadway shows.
But they weren't getting the money.
Of course not. They weren't getting the money. They were getting a fraction. And
where did they live? Did they?
They lived in villages, but ultimately they became part of a kind of a sub. Well, I wouldn't say, you know, a part of a working class people, because they did these shows. And then when the shows were over, one guy I talk about in my show, his last name was Amok, coincidentally, James Robert Amok. I call him Jimmy Bob because he was really Americanized. So Americanized, they drafted him in World War I. And they said, we need your savagery, Jimmy Bob. And Jimmy Bob said, I'm only a savage during business hours. Well, thank you for letting me. There's more jokes in the play, but I'm doing this. Like I said, Jimmy Bob. I didn't realize he existed until I did more research, and you know, the Washington Post wrote about this story. He was drafted when the Coup de Guerre in 1915 in World War One.
That's an award from the French surrendering?
That's a special award for being, you know, for valor. And what happened was, when he came back, he was treated like any other veteran. Not very well. The only job he could get was, he was part of a variety show. Now, they went from human zoos to variety show, right? That's how they make it better, right? That's like you were saying earlier, showbiz, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they would do, he would climb up a tree, like some kind of facsimile of a coconut tree, and at the top yell at the top of his lungs, he would just yell at the enemy, and then climb down. And he was asked, because Pulitzer, right? The Pulitzer paper used to cover the Filipinos a lot and all the tabloids in New York. And they'd say, well, what do you think, Jimmy Bob? And he'd say, well, it's kind of degrading, but it pays the bills.
It's show business.
It's show business, yeah. And he died. Jimmy Bob Amuck, James Robert Amuck, died in 1950. And he's buried in Long Island. And it's something. It's like, my father came in 1928. I don't think he knew Jimmy Bob or who he was. But that was sort of like the legacy of the Filipino, right? When my father came in 28, and then the anti-intermarriage laws happened, and I wasn't born until later in the, after the World War II in the 50s. I was part of the last part of the baby boom. Mm-hmm. And this is part of an untold history that shows you how really the pattern of how we treat people of color, each other.
Yeah. And when people uphold the patriarchy, when they say that we need to keep things the way they are, they're only trying to protect what they have.
Right. Well, we're seeing it now, aren't we?
Yeah, I've been watching a lot of these, like these Jordan Petersons, these conservatives.
Oh, yeah.
And they dance around. They just dance around the issue. But they're just trying to keep what they have, and they're infiltrating the universities using Koch money, pretending that they're proponents of free speech. But they're just very slippery people who are being paid by white supremacists, members of the patriarchy, to teach kids that they shouldn't question what already exists, and they're trying to train kids to just accept things the way they are.
Well, they the thing is that if they weren't there,
who?
I think if these Jordan Petersons and the people who are trying to uphold the status quo or trying to shore up the diminishing of the status quo. I think we're starting. If they weren't there, you'd see young people adopt even quicker some of the things that we'd like to see in an ideal world. I mean, there's changes all around, and if it weren't for that, that counterforce, we would probably see it more clearly. But if all you have to do is. All you have to do is talk to some young people, in their, 20s, and you see that they're very different. I mean, maybe it's just because I talk to my kids and they don't, it's all different, right? And they see the world totally different, and that's a good thing, except on holidays. I think.
Yeah. Well, I could go on and on about Jordan Peterson. I went down that wormhole over the weekend.
Yeah.
After that. Yeah. That article that appeared in the New York Times about the intellectual dark web.
Oh, yeah.
And they're not intellectuals.
No, they're reactionaries.
They're reactionaries. And the definition of a reactionary is somebody who wants to return to a different time. Reactionary, that's the definition of somebody. I call it revanchism, where you want to get back the country that you've been kicked out of. And they're dangerous. Anyway, we have to wrap it up. But Emil Guillermo is appearing Wednesday night at the Orlando Fringe Festival.
On there the through, the 25th. Huh? Yeah, through the 25th. Through the 25th. It's like seven shows.
In the Blue Venue. The name of the show is?
Amok Monologues, All Fucked Up, NPR, Harvard, and More.
NPR, Harvard, and More. And he also does the PETA podcast, which you can listen to on iTunes and Stitcher, wherever fine podcasts are found. Stay on the line, sir.
Will do.